Okay, good morning, everybody. This is about 2:41, and it's February 9th. We're going to hopefully finish chapter 6 today, so that all we have to do next week is chapter 3 before the test. And don't forget, this is a pretty nice advanced class, but we still have old-time tests to do. And let's see, let's take a look at the schedule. Here's the schedule, so don't forget, here we are, February 9th. I see I got to turn my microphone up. Some people are talking over the microphone, but guess what? You will lose. Because I can turn the microphone up even louder and louder and louder and louder. Okay, oh, you're still trying. Okay, you guys, hold on. You might be disturbing somebody that's next to you. So become familiar with the syllabus, right? And our first exam is on February 21st. That's right after President's Day holiday weekend. Not next week, but a week from Tuesday coming up next week. All right, so we're going to finish up here. Anybody have any questions on what you should be studying for the exam? Okay, what's your question? Be happy to answer some questions. Focus on the study guide. Yeah, print that study guide out, label figures, look at end of chapter questions. There are check your concept questions, I think, in the middle of every chapter before you move on to a section. Make sure you understand what's going on there. There's online questions as well, and pre-lecture reading assignment. I could probably lift any of those questions and put it on the exam, and for sure I will photocopy some figures from the book and put them on the exam that you have to relabel. And also a real important slide that was given to you in lab, a PowerPoint slide on a response loop you should really know backwards and forwards. Where's the set point? Where's the integration center? Okay, yeah, and all that kind of stuff. All right, just that slide. Be able to draw that slide in your mind. Okay, let's see. I was showing you a video as you walked into class today. Let me see if I can get back over here. And that video contains all the structures, chemical structures, right? Amino acids, different kinds of nucleotides, etc., fatty acids. And it is right here. Chemical flash quiz. So this is just drjgober.com. You can go there, play. We were just streaming off this server, but you might want to download this and put it on your hard drive so that you can practice it anytime you want without having internet access, and use a DVX media player. But it seemed like the Windows media player was working just fine, but make sure you update your Windows media player. Otherwise, you might get the audio but not the video, or you might get the video not the audio. And that's not so satisfying, right? You want to have both working together. All right, so go to this website, and I didn't get the lectures available yet. I still ran into a problem, but they will be available maybe tonight, maybe tomorrow, right here under. So it's going to show up right here. This is going to be spring 2012. But if you want to listen to any previous lectures from previous years, you're welcome to go in there and look at them. For example, here is the audio file recording of the lecture. Here's a transcript of it. So if you like to read transcripts instead of listen to audios, you can do that. Or if you're hearing impaired, you can read the transcript. All right, so that will be available for you. One last thing. Some people, it missed their attention that the week 2 online quiz was the same week for the week 1 online quiz, because I made week 1 a little bit longer than 1 week. So I reactivated the week 2 online quiz. So if you didn't do it, make sure you go back and get it done by, I think, next Wednesday is when I have the date. But I sent an email to everybody. If you didn't get the email, then you got a problem with your email. It's spamming the email that I sent you, or you don't have a valid email address in my gateway. And you really want to have a valid email address in my gateway, because I send you important things during the semester. All right, so that's some bookkeeping for today. And does anybody have any questions about what we were talking about last time in lecture? All right, so it was mostly osmosis and diffusion. And I guess I could ask you a really quick question. Is osmosis diffusion? Yes, that's nice. And what about diffusion? Is that osmosis? Not necessarily. Yeah, under certain conditions it is, and you should know what those conditions are. Let's see, if I punch that button, oh no, I don't want to do that. I want to go here, I got to put it in slideshow mode first, sorry about this. What happened, where does the slide go when I put it in slideshow mode? Oh, like that. Okay, I can do that. Nice. All right, and then we talked about how important it is to know something about osmotic pressure that is developed as a result of a concentration gradient across a plasma membrane, right? Because you can crenate cells or you can hemolyze cells depending on the type of solution you put living tissue in. And it has severe biological consequences if it is not an isotonic solution. All right, so let's do these. Let's see. Okay. Let's see if this works. All right, so then we got to membrane transport systems, and that's where we're going to take off today, membrane transport systems, because biological cells have what kind of plasma membrane? What kind of membrane surrounds the cell? Yeah, it's a phospholipid bilayer. That's a nice structure of that membrane. So the interior parts of that membrane are lipids, which is an oily compound, which means it's hydrophobic. Right, so hydrophobic molecules can move across the membrane, but not hydrophilic molecules. They can't get through that inner part of the plasma membrane. So then I kind of go back to my original question. What kind of membrane is it? It allows some things through, but not other things. Yeah, that's what I was really thinking. It really helps if you can read my mind. But once I develop the question properly, you can see what I'm saying. Okay, so membranes, biological membranes, are selectively permeable or semi-permeable. So not everything can go across, but there might be some hydrophilic molecules that your cell wants to move into the cell, all right, but it just won't happen by diffusion. It needs some kind of carrier for that to happen. All right, and those are hydrophilic compounds, so compounds that like to dissolve in water. Can you give me an example of a compound that likes to dissolve in water? Like salt, sodium, chloride, glucose even, right? So these kinds of molecules cannot pass through the plasma membrane because that hydrophobic region on the inside of the membrane prevents that molecule to move across. So molecules that are too large or polar, okay, to diffuse are transported across the membrane by protein carriers. And we're going to look at some of these protein carriers. Right, and the molecule that's being transported must bind to the membrane protein carrier first before it is transported. Okay, so binding has to occur. All right, so here we have a graph that shows the rate of transport of some molecule. We're just going to call it X. All right, and here is a plot versus the concentration of X across the membrane. So as we increase the concentration of X, and let's just the concentration of X, what happens to the rate of transport across the membrane as we increase the concentration on the outside of the cell? What happens to the transport inside the cell? Look at your solid line right here. As the concentration increases, so does the rate of transport. Okay? All right. So, and then you also see that as we continue to increase the concentration of X, the rate of transport, what? Starts to not increase quite so much for the same step of increase in concentration of X. And then finally, when we get way out over here, if we increase the concentration of X, the rate does not increase any further. This is a nice curve, right, that we're going to model a lot of physiologic systems by. So we want to characterize this kind of curve right here and characterize carrier-mediated transport a little bit. So proteins exhibit specificity for a single kind of molecule. All right, so not any molecule is going to be transported by this particular protein, only the X molecule, and it's going to be by shape. All right, so if the molecule has the right shape, it can be transported. Let's think of kind of a wild example. Let's just say there's going to be a party this afternoon at Bolsa Chica, okay, and we're stuck over here. How are we going to get out to Bolsa Chica Beach? We're going to catch some kind of transporter to take us over there, like a car, let's say a nice Volkswagen, okay? And it's a party for X kind of molecules. Oh, sorry, my cursor disappeared. Sorry, got to wiggle it. Okay, and this molecule will be female humans, okay? We could think of X as being a female, all right? And so let's just say that we have, like, at first, we have one female that gets outside by the curb, okay, and hops in the car. So the rate of transport of females to the beach is relatively small because there's only one female ready to go, okay? And then let's just say somebody is an equestrian, really loves horses. There's a gal that really loves horses. And so she has an idea, you know what? I'd really like to take all my horses to the beach as well. So now there is a female with like 5 horses, and we still have that Volkswagen. Who's going to make it to the beach? Not all those horses, because they don't fit inside the Volkswagen, right? Because the horses just don't have the right size and shape to fit in there, right? So molecules for transport also have to have the right size and shape to get to Bolsa Chica or to move across the membrane, right? So you have to be about the right size organism to get transported in that car. All right, so now instead of that lady with all of her horses, now we have 10 women. Okay, they won't all fit in the Volkswagen at the same time. So what can you tell me about the rate of transport to Bolsa Chica? Okay, even though we have more women that want to go there, it still levels off. We call that saturation. All right, so then the car is completely saturated with women, and we, even though a lot of women want to get to Bolsa Chica, they just can't fit in the car. So the rate of transport just kind of levels off as a result of that. And then if we have like 1,000 women want to go and we still have that one car, what's the rate of transport? It's still the same as if there are only 5 women that wanted to go. We call that saturation. All right, then there's another term called competition among substrates. So instead of just having women and horses that want to go, we have women and then a couple of guys show up. All right, so maybe 5 guys want to get to Bolsa Chica, right, with all of the women. What happens to the transport of women to Bolsa Chica when that happens? Can guys fit in the car? Yeah, because they basically have the same kind of shape. Not exactly, but close, right? All right, so then we put 3 guys in the car. What happens to the number of women? Okay, it goes down. So we call that competition. So if you have similar kinds of molecules that will fit onto that carrier, right, but they're not all exactly the same, the molecule that we're considering that transport of, which is what? Just women in this particular case, goes down because there's competition from guys that want to get there as well. All right, so that you might consider different kinds of molecules. Maybe there's a glucose molecule, and there's another molecule that has a very similar shape. That's called galactose. That's a nice monosaccharide. So if we have a transporter for glucose, and it just so happens that there's galactose around in that same area, all right, it's very similar in shape, so that will exhibit competition. It will bind to the transporter, and when galactose binds to that transporter, then glucose can't bind, and then glucose can't be transported. All right, so this is actually a pretty handy little graph to analyze and look at. And this right here says what the transport maximum is. This is the concentration of X, where the transporters are basically completely saturated, and even if we increase the concentration of X, we can't increase the rate of transport. This is something that we see with diabetics, where there's a special glucose transporter in the kidney that is going to take all of the glucose that is going to end up in urine. We'll take it from that filtrate, put it back in the blood, because glucose is an important energy molecule. But if glucose is so high in your blood and you have so much glucose in the urine, it saturates all the transporters. Glucose can't be resorbed, and then as a result, right, of exceeding the transport maximum, then somebody that has uncontrolled diabetes will be losing glucose in the urine because it can't all be transported back into the body. All right, so that would be a nice sign for diabetes mellitus. So these are some important daily implications for these transporters. So let's look at some graphics of transporters. All right, so here we have a slide. We have a nice phospholipid bilayer right here, but I also see a protein embedded in this particular membrane, and this is a transporter, and I see a high concentration of glucose, and you maybe should recognize this glucose molecule because it looks like a nice stop sign right here, or just a single stop sign. So here's a monosaccharide. It's at high concentration outside the cell, low concentration inside. But the cell needs glucose to make ATP, so this cell wants to take up glucose from the extracellular material right here. All right. Now, does glucose all by itself want to enter the cell by diffusion or by osmosis? And I see people shaking their head yes, and I like that answer a lot, because how does diffusion always work? From high concentration to low. So yeah, glucose is dying to get into that cell, okay, but can it? Can it get inside the cell? Because this hydrophobic region, this interior part of the membrane, is preventing glucose from moving across this region to get into the side of the cell. All right, so glucose wants to get in, but it can't. But the cell wants some glucose, so it builds this special membrane, the special protein, inserts it into the membrane. Here is the binding site for a molecule. Now, do you think a steroid could bind to this binding site? Or a prostaglandin? Or an amino acid? It does not. Those molecules don't have the right shape, so they're going to be excluded by that specificity rule. Right, so glucose has the right shape. It has a complementary shape that fits into this binding site on this transporter. And when it binds right here, it causes this protein to act like a teeter-totter. So then it opens up on the inside of the cell and closes off on the outside, and now glucose is released to the inside of the cell. All right, so this is what we call facilitated diffusion. No energy is necessary. We don't see ATP being used right here. The only thing we see is that glucose has to bind to this transporter, and it can move from high concentration to low. And what kind of process is it when something moves from high concentration to low? We should be able to talk about that a little bit. What do you know about that kind of process? It's a nice passive process. All right, diffusion is a good example of that. Now, could this be osmosis? Okay, for a number of different reasons. Well, one reason in particular, not a number. There's one reason, because osmosis has to do with a water molecule only, right? Not a solute molecule like glucose in this particular case. All right, so this is a typical kind of trick that cells employ to take up glucose. For instance, from the blood, what happens to the concentration of glucose in the blood when the cell takes it up? It goes down, okay? And if glucose cannot enter the cell because these transporters aren't working, then the concentration of glucose in the blood remains high or stays high maybe all night long, right? So that's a condition of diabetes when that happens, okay? So when you have diabetes, cells are starving of glucose. So that's a really terrible condition. It's got to be controlled, right, or it's going to be fatal. And actually, terrible consequences happen along the way before you die when you have diabetes mellitus. If you leave it uncontrolled, what are some consequences if you leave it untreated before you die? Yeah, you go blind, kidney failure, okay, and cardiovascular disease as well. Blood won't reach your extremities, so usually extremities have to be amputated, hands and feet, fingers and things like that. So if you know anybody with diabetes mellitus, be really nice to them, help them be compliant, right? So you just have to work with people to help them and manage that particular circumstance. All right, so this is diffusion, but it's not simple diffusion because you need this protein in the membrane, so we call it facilitated diffusion. But nonetheless, it's a passive process, molecules moving from high concentration to low. Even though it's a selectively permeable membrane, it is still not osmosis. And your cells can regulate how much glucose they take up. For instance, when blood glucose levels decrease, we looked at a slide, a flow diagram of this before, when blood glucose levels decrease, then the uptake from the blood is regulated and is decreased to maintain blood glucose levels. So then these transporters here are taken out of the membrane and put in something we call an endosome inside the cell. All right, so these transporters are not broken down, they're not destroyed, they're not wasted, they're just taken out of the plasma membrane, put into a vesicle which we call an endosome, which is what we see right here. Here I see a lot of glucose transporters, and that endosome is a storage place for membrane proteins, which can be inserted into the plasma membrane very rapidly to change the function of the cell to uptake glucose. And this can be done very rapidly. It might take days to build the number of glucose transporters that are necessary in your body. So the way that your cell can adjust very rapidly is to build a whole bunch of these transporters, insert them into an endosome where they are inactive, but if the proper signal then is sent to the cell, this vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane like we see right here, and then all of a sudden, voila, you have hundreds of these transporters ready to go to work, and you don't have to build them de novo. So it's very fast, kind of ingenious way of working out that control mechanism for glucose uptake inside the cell. All right, So we have passive transport, talked about passive transport. What's the other general form of transport? Active transport. Oh, one last thing I wanted to say. All right, so when glucose binds to this protein transporter right here, it changes the conformation of this protein. Okay, it doesn't require ATP, but it changes the conformation of this protein. Think of you're sitting right next to your friend, and during the middle of lecture, your friend takes their index finger and pokes you in the side. That would be like binding of a glucose molecule to that protein right there. What are you going to do when your friend pokes you in the side? You're going to change your conformation, right? No big energy change, but you're going to change conformation, and that's just, so think of this glucose when it binds right here. It's like poking this protein in the side, and it's going to change conformation. Okay, active transport, a little bit different. All right, it's a way where molecules can go from low concentration to high concentration, right? It's the opposite motion, and it requires ATP for that to happen. Requires some kind of energy source. Maybe not ATP exactly in every circumstance, which we'll look at in this chapter, but some kind of energy source. So if you see in this particular example, calcium going from low to high across this membrane right here, could that be osmosis? No. Could that be diffusion? I tried to trick you, and maybe I tricked some of you. What is diffusion? High concentration to low. But if you go from low to high, that can't be diffusion. That is active transport, which we have up here on this slide. Okay, now how can that happen? It is possible for that to happen because here is a calcium. Now, what kind of molecule is this calcium right here? It's a cation. Oh, but what kind of cation? What kind? Divalent cation. Yeah, really nice. So that's an electrolyte, right? A divalent cation. Just by diffusion, it's going to move around inside the cell, and it's going to bump into this protein embedded in the membrane, and it's going to bind to this site right over here. But there's not enough energy when it binds to the site to cause this conformation change so that it can escape to the outside of the cell. Right? This membrane protein needs ATP. So ATP will bind to another site, like right about here, and ATP will be hydrolyzed. Right? Hydrolysis is an energy-releasing reaction. And then a phosphate molecule will bind to this protein, ADP will be released, and the bond between ADP and this inorganic phosphate right here releases energy, and that changes the conformation in this protein. So that's like your friend taking all of their hands and then grabbing you in the side, which means what? You're really going to change conformation, right? So ATP can cause this conformation change. I'll get my cursor back in a second. Here it is. Causes this conformation change. So now calcium can move out into the extracellular space right here. And it has effectively gone from what? Low concentration to high concentration at the expense of what? An ATP molecule. Okay. So this is an example of active transport. And in particular, what we call this is primary active transport. And we call it primary active transport because there is a big sign on this diagram that tells me it's primary active transport. Okay? And I see it. I don't think you see it yet. Should I tell you what it is, what that big sign is for primary active transport? Is I see an ATP molecule right here. So if you see an ATP molecule, that's going to be primary active transport. And routinely, we call these kinds of proteins in a membrane that can move molecules from low to high concentration a pump. Just like we can move water that's underground to above ground so that we can consume it, what do we call a mechanism that can take water that's in a well, bring it up so that we can use it for our purposes? That's a pump, right? But it takes energy to get that water out of the ground because water is going from low to high. Okay, here is a very important pump. Most of the energy in your body is used to run just this one pump, this one system. All cells have something that we call the sodium-potassium pump. Oh, one last thing when we go back to this slide right here. Where is calcium at a high concentration on this slide? Outside the cell. And you're going to see that that is true almost everywhere in your body. Okay, so when we start looking at some of these ion concentrations, calcium will be high outside, relatively low inside. All right, so here, instead of talking about calcium, we see what's K? Potassium, and what's Na? sodium. Okay, so here we see the extracellular space, here's the intracellular space. Here is a membrane protein that's embedded in the plasma membrane, and it will use ATP to move potassium, which is at low concentration outside the cell, to high concentration inside the cell. So that's the reverse of diffusion, so that's active transport. Okay, and is that primary active transport? There is a big sign on this slide that tells you yes or no. And here it is right here, ATP. So this is indeed primary active transport because it's getting energy directly from ATP, primary active transport. ATP is broken down to ADP and inorganic phosphate. That covalent bond has a lot of energy, and it can be used to change the conformation of this protein. But that's not all that it does. It doesn't just take potassium from the outside, putting it on the inside of the cell, but it'll also take sodium that's on the inside and put it on the outside. And the bold letters right here signify high concentration compared to just the unbold letters right here, which means low concentration. So what do we call it when something goes from low to high concentration? Active transport, right? So potassium is being actively moved. Sodium is being actively moved. These are in opposite directions, and this would be a nice example of what kind of active transport? Primary active transport. And like I said, most of the ATP in your body is used just to drive these kinds of pumps that you have in all the cells of your body, and they're working all the time. Question?
How does it go back to homeostasis?
This is a relatively unstable state. All right, and we're going to look to see what the cell does with these gradients right here. And we're going to look at that probably through the whole rest of the class. So I'm going to say, you know what, it's going to take me a lot of lectures to tell you about how this is maintaining homeostasis. If the cell is at rest, okay, and homeostasis is being maintained, then potassium will be at a high concentration inside the cell, and sodium will be at a high concentration outside the cell. And I'll just leave it as for that at the moment, okay? Okay. All right, so let's look at another kind of active transport. All right, requires ATP. For instance, let's look at this diagram over here. It's kind of an abstract diagram that might relate to what's happening inside your cell. So we see sodium, the sodium ion. We're not thinking about potassium right at the moment. All right, and sodium is going to go from low concentration to high concentration based on what kind of mechanism? The sodium-potassium ATP pump. Okay, so it's going to pump sodium outside the cell, from inside to outside the cell. So we have high sodium on the outside of the cell, and we see a nice concentration gradient. All right, so we move sodium up this concentration gradient. It's like moving it up this hill. And what kind of active transport is that when we move sodium from low to high concentration across the cell membrane? Primary active transport, right? And that's even on this slide right here. I think I modified the slide a little bit compared to your book, but this is the one that's in your exam study guide. So it requires ATP, right? Just like if you're going to carry a bowling ball up these stairs right here, that requires energy. To pump sodium out of the cell is going to require energy in the form of ATP, and because you got ATP right here, that is primary active transport. All right, so now what can you tell me, if we were to turn that pump off, what does sodium like to do? It would like to roll back down the hill, okay? And when it rolls back down the hill, it's going to be releasing energy that it gained when it went up the hill, right? So we can take the sodium to the precipice of this hill right here and drop it on this teeter-totter. And when it falls down on this teeter-totter that is up in the air, right, what's going to happen to the other end of the teeter-totter? It's going to get jammed up in the air, and here we have a glucose molecule at low concentration, right, and it's connected to this mechanism right here so that when sodium goes back into the cell, okay, it's going to move glucose from low concentration to high concentration. And if you look on this side of the hill, do you see any ATP being used? No, there's no ATP being used, but glucose is still going from low concentration to high. Anything going from low to high is what kind of transport, passive or active? It's active. It's active transport when something goes from low to high, But it's not primary active transport because there's no ATP being used. It's the gradient of sodium that is being used to do this work right here, right? So what we see is glucose moving from low to high. It requires energy in the form of a chemical gradient, and the chemical gradient is what? Sodium, high to low. All right, so we're going to make an equation right here. We're going to say that the chemical gradient is equal to what? The chemical gradient is equal to ATP. All right, so ATP is a form of energy. It can do work. The chemical gradient is a form of energy, and it's able to do work as well. Cells have been able to harness the energy in a chemical gradient. Right, and you have a lot of devices in your pocket that work by this mechanism right here. You have a battery, which is just a gradient of electrons in some kind of little device, and those electrons like to go from high concentration to low concentration, and that's called a current, and that current can be used to drive your calculators and cell phones and all that cool kind of stuff. Right? You don't have ATP in your cell phones. You have a chemical gradient of electricity, basically, ions, to do work for you. All right, so this slide is pretty important because you see primary active transport, which is due to ATP, and then secondary active transport, which is due to a chemical gradient. And that's always going to be a dead giveaway on an illustration someplace as to what kind of active transport it is. All right, some other things about secondary active transport. So let me just quiz you really fast. Secondary active transport. Things can move from low to high, but does it require ATP? No. Does it require energy of some kind? Absolutely. Another example would be what? A chemical gradient, for instance. All right, so if it's secondary active transport, there are still some other characterizations that we want to make. All right, so here is a nice membrane with a protein in it. So here's a protein transporter. And there are two binding sites on this transporter right here. One is for sodium and one is for glucose. Right, so both of these molecules have to move into this protein and bind. And guess what happens when they bind? Do I have to poke you in the side? No, I don't. Because you know it's going to change the conformation of that protein, right? Okay. And so now, instead of being outside the cell, right, glucose and sodium are inside the cell, and glucose and sodium move inside the cell. All right, now where is sodium at a high concentration? In a normal resting cell. It's outside. So it wants to get inside the cell, right? It's dying to get inside the cell. But can it? No, because the plasma membrane is excluding it. All right, so sodium wants to get inside the cell. It's high on the outside, low on the inside. All right, so that's a concentration gradient. And what is that really? What is that concentration gradient of sodium? How should you think of it? It's like a charged battery. There's energy in that gradient, right? So that energy can be used to move glucose from low concentration on the outside of the cell to high concentration on the inside. Okay, can you picture that? I don't know, a lot of words, but hopefully I explained it well enough. That big gradient in sodium can be used, which goes down the concentration gradient, for sodium can be used to bring glucose inside the cell that is actually going up the concentration gradient. So in this particular case, the sodium right here is acting like it is extending energy to this process so that glucose can go from low concentration to high. So glucose moves up its concentration gradient as well. So would you call this primary active transport or secondary active transport? Secondary because why? No ATP being used. All right. And in particular, since both molecules that are being transported go in the same direction, which is the point of this slide right here, is what we call co-transport or symport. I like to use symport, but either one is fine, right? Sometimes a process or even a structure in your body can have more than one name. For instance, in anatomy, co-transport and symport are the same. It just means that the two transported molecules are moving in the same direction. And co-transport or symport only happens for secondary active transport, not for primary active transport. Counterport or antiport moves one molecule in one direction and the second molecule in the opposite direction. That's also a special kind of protein that can allow that process to happen. All right, and that's an antiporter, and it is only for secondary active transport. We'll never see ATP used. All right, so let's put all of these different transporters together to see how, in a nice simple scheme, it works inside our body. All right, so here we see a nice epithelium. How would you classify this epithelium right here? You're close. I hear it coming out. Simple, and it looks like a cuboidal cell, right? So here's a simple cuboidal epithelium. Here's the basal membrane right here, or the basal lateral surface. Here's the apical surface. And cells are really fancy. They're pretty smart. They can make the apical membrane a lot different than the basal membrane by putting different kinds of proteins in these two different areas so that they have different functions. So this right here is the lining of a tube inside your body. So what do we call the interior compartment of a tube? The lumen, right? So here's the lumen of the tube, and then here is blood or maybe extracellular space, right, that's inside your body. This lumen is maybe outside your body. So this is the lumen of a kidney tubule, or maybe part of the digestive tract, which is really outside your body. The lumen of a kidney tubule is really outside your body. And so you have filtrate in the kidney. In that filtrate, this fluid right here, you have glucose, and you don't want to lose any glucose in the urine. This fluid right here is going to be excreted from your body, and it has an important energy molecule. You don't want to lose that in urine, right? You don't want to urinate it from your body. You want it inside. So how are we going to get this glucose in the filtrate here into the blood? That's what this scheme talks about. So maybe an example of why that is so important, you don't want to lose glucose, like what happens during diabetes mellitus. Just let's say you go to the gas station and you have to pay $5 for a gallon of gas, right? So you fill up your gas tank. How would it be for you then, after you fill up your gas tank, to go to your gas tank with an ice pick and put a hole in it so now you got gas dribbling out of the gas tank? That would be a big waste of money, right? So somebody that has diabetes mellitus, that's exactly what's happening. They take all this glucose in their body and then they lose it. Cells start to die, they starve to death because you're losing glucose in the urine. So, under normal circumstances, all of this glucose gets reabsorbed by the body, even though glucose is at a very low concentration. Your body wants every little bit put back in because it's an important energy molecule. So how can things go from low concentration to high? And what is movement from low concentration to high concentration? That's active transport, right? And now you know two kinds of active transport. What is that? Primary, which requires ATP, secondary, which does not require. But it requires what? A gradient of some kind of ion, because that's an energy source. All right, so here we have the apical surface, and you can see nice microvilli right here. Oh, what do microvilli do to this cell? Increase the surface area, right, for transport, because now we can put a whole lot of transporters right here. So here is a protein. We have sodium at a high concentration in the filtrate of that kidney tubule, high outside the cell. It's low inside. So what does sodium want to do? What is it dying to do? Run down its concentration gradient. Ah, but what is that really? What is that really? That concentration gradient right there. That's energy. Yeah, that's like ATP, right? That gradient is like having ATP. Can be used to do work. And then we have glucose that's low in the tubule right here and high inside the cell. And your body wants that glucose. It doesn't want to leave it stranded, home alone in the filtrate right here. It wants to take that glucose up. But will glucose want to go from low to high concentration all by itself? No, it can't. It needs an energy supply, which means active transport. So there's a special protein right here that will bind sodium and glucose, just like on the previous slide. This protein will change conformation. Now both sodium and glucose will be inside the cell. All right, so that's a form of active transport. What kind of active transport is that? Is it primary or secondary? You see ATP? No ATP, so it's secondary active transport. Furthermore, we could classify that as to being what kind of secondary active transport. If both molecules move in the same direction, that is co-transport or symporter. So here's a nice symporter protein right here. All right, so now we got sodium low that's inside the cell, glucose inside the cell, but we want glucose inside the blood. It just so happens that blood glucose is regulated to be relatively low, so glucose wants to move from inside of this epithelial cell into the blood, right? It wants to go from high to low, but can it? No, because it can't get through the plasma membrane. So what does it need? Some kind of carrier molecule. And when glucose goes from high to low with the use of a carrier molecule, we call that facilitated diffusion, right? So now glucose ends up in the blood, all which is wonderful, okay? Now, what about the sodium right here? It's coming in from the filtrate, but we want to keep sodium low inside the cell. How can we do that? We want to take sodium from low concentration and put it back to high concentration inside the blood. What do we need? We need a pump. And a perfect pump that's really ready to do this is the sodium-potassium pump, all right? And, of course, it requires ATP. So what kind of process is this right here, active or passive? It's active because sodium is going from low to high, and so it's active. And what kind of active transport? There's a nice primary active transport signal right there, which is the ATP molecule. All right, so the bottom line then, glucose, all the glucose that's normally in filtrate can be imported back into the body using this mechanism right here, as long as you have what to set this whole system up. What is the ultimate energy molecule that you need? You need this ATP to maintain the gradient, right, which can be used for secondary active transport. All right, so you can imagine then how important ATP is. All right, so from anatomy, I think you should remember these terms. Absorption is a transport of molecules from your digestive system into your body. Remember, what's in your digestive system is really not inside your body. It's just inside a tube that's running through your body, right? So absorption is the process of actually getting it into your blood. Reabsorption transports compounds that are in the filtrate of a kidney tubule back into the body. So remember, there's tubular secretion, tubular reabsorption, and then filtration. Those three processes you should know from anatomy. Reabsorption is what? Going from the filtrate back into the blood in those different kidney tubules. So this is an exam figure, and also next week, this is one that I want you to draw in lab for extra credit. Okay? And I'll send an email about that maybe later tonight. Okay? Because it's really, really important. You get to draw that before the test. All right, there's another kind of active transport that we call bulk transport, and that's when we have a plasma membrane form a little dimple right here in the surface of the cell so that material just kind of flows into this little dimple, and this could be fluid, or it could be solutes, or it could even be particulate matter like this, and then the cell, the membrane extends a little bit further into the cell, and then if the membrane folds back on itself, and then it pinches off, right here, and now you have a vesicle inside the cell with fluids or particulate matter or maybe even bacteria, for instance, that are really literally inside the cell. All right, so here is the extracellular fluid, here is cytoplasm. When things are on the outside and move in, we call that endocytosis. All right, the opposite can take place. You might have material inside of a vesicle right here. It could be a fluid or particulate matter or solutes in a vesicle. That vesicle can move over to the plasma membrane, and the membrane of this vesicle and the plasma membrane are basically the same thing. They have the same building block, so they really like to fuse together. So it fuses together, and then the vesicle membrane is pulled so that it opens to the outside of the cell, and so we call this secretion of these compounds to the outside of the cell. More generally, we call that exocytosis. All right, so this is the end part of a secretory pathway. All right, now this stuff just doesn't happen magically like diffusion does. It's an active process. All right, so bulk transport is a form of what? Active or passive transport? Active or passive? Requires ATP. We don't have a nice ATP sign on here, but what's moving these things around are microfilaments and microtubules inside the cell, which are connected to integrin proteins that are in the membranes of this vesicle and the plasma membrane. So think of that microtubule system as like being a monorail system, a little railway system inside the cell that organelles can hop a ride on to get to other places of the cell, like chromosomes during mitosis. And also, those microtubules can shape the cell because it acts like a skeletal system inside the cell. It can change the form of the plasma membrane, or the shape of the plasma membrane. So these are all examples of active transport. And as a matter of fact, endocytosis has two different forms. I don't know if I have it on a slide. I don't have it on a slide, but I'm sure you're familiar with it already. What are the two forms, the two words that describe two different forms of endocytosis? Yeah, phagocytosis, if it is a particle that's being endocytosed, or if it's just fluid, we would call that pinocytosis, right? So pinocytosis is just the endocytosis of fluid. Okay, and that's active. All right, here is a very interesting part of the class. It's called membrane potential. And when you think of potential, that means it's the ability to make something happen. And in the particular, what we're going to be talking about is a voltage. So membrane potential and membrane voltage are going to be the same thing. But we were always going to talk about it in terms of voltage. All right, so for instance, there is a wire potential in this room. Right? It has the ability to do something. Right? What is that wire potential? Not membrane potential, but a wire potential. What's that? Oh, these light switches right here, right? Control the voltage to these lights. I don't like them all on. Hopefully I'll turn these back off. I don't like those on. Okay, so we can use that voltage to do things in here, like turn the lights on and off. Cells can do the same thing, right? But we call it a membrane potential, or you could call it a membrane voltage. All right, so what devices do you own that contain a voltage? Cell phone has a battery, okay? And one part of the battery, there's high electrons. On the other side of the battery, there's low electrons. And so what do these electrons like to do? They like to cancel, right? They like to become equilibrium, same concentration. So those electrons like to flow. We call that an electrical current. And what is that gradient? What is that gradient of electrons, really? Just like that gradient of sodium. What is it, really? It's energy, right? So that gradient of electron is energy that can be used to drive your MP3 players and transmitters for microphone and cell phones and all that kind of stuff. All right, and how many terminals does a battery have? It has two. And fortunately, cells have two terminals as well, and those terminals will be the outside of the plasma membrane, that's one, and the other terminal is going to be inside the plasma membrane. All right, so it's the plasma membrane that separates these charges out. All right, so the membrane potential is just a difference in charges across a cell membrane. So here is a cell, kind of a nice simple picture of a cell. All right, and inside the cell, we have a lot of proteins. And these are really large molecules that can't get outside the cell, and there's no transporters to take them outside the cell. And it just so happens they're loaded with negative charge. So you have proteins that are stuck inside the cell, and they're all negative charge. So what do we call those things? They have a negative charge, anions, right? And what can you tell me about molecules that have a positive charge? Molecules that have a positive charge, will they be attracted to these ions, anions right here, or repelled by them? Opposite electrical charges attract each other, right? So these anions inside the cell can't get out, which are negative. They're going to attract positive molecules to the inside of the cell. So there is what? An electrical attraction. And the molecule that we're going to be concerned with is going to be potassium. Let's just think about potassium. Will potassium be attracted by these fixed anions? Absolutely, because potassium is a cation. All right, so potassium is going to want to come in to neutralize the electrical environment inside the cell. But as these anions draw potassium inside the cell, we get a high concentration of potassium on the inside and low potassium on the outside. So what does potassium want to do? It's torn. It's drawn in by these negative charges, but because of the concentration gradient, it wants to equalize the concentration gradient, so some are going to want to leave, right? Until what? The concentration is exactly the same. But when the concentration is exactly the same, right, then these ions, the anions, want to pull some cations inside the cell. And what happens is there's a funny kind of equilibrium that develops so that we have a little bit higher concentration of potassium inside the cell compared to outside the cell. So the electrical attraction exactly balances out the concentration gradient right here, which is trying to drive the potassium ions out. Right, so these are going to be opposite and equal. So we're just saying in this particular case, potassium is able to move through this membrane, and that's due to channels that are in the cell membrane. All right, so the electrical force is drawing cations in, but the concentration force is shoving potassium out, and after a relatively long period of time, that is going to balance out to where there's not going to be any change in net change in potassium entering or leaving this particular cell right here. Okay. And when that happens, we can put a voltmeter across the cell membrane and we can measure the voltage, just like you could measure the voltage on a battery, right, across this membrane, because the voltmeter has two terminals. You put it on two terminals of a battery. When that happens, we see that the outside of the cell is a little bit positive, and the inside of the cell still remains a little bit negative because there aren't enough potassium ions that can get inside the cell to neutralize every single anion that's inside the cell. Because as we build up the concentration of potassium, what does it want to do just by a concentration gradient? It wants to go back out, right? Okay. So every cell looks just like this. So every living cell inside your body acts like a battery. So you're very electrical. Your basic nature is extremely electrical. And why is it electrical? Because you have all of these ions inside your body. And you even know now how to develop these ions based on shell chemical theory, right? Electrons in shells and things like that. Okay, so when the potassium concentration stabilizes on the inside compared to the outside of the cell, okay, we call that the equilibrium potential. So we're measuring the equilibrium potential, right? It's still going to be a little bit negative inside the cell, but if it gets any more positive inside the cell, okay, then potassium is going to want to leave, and then it goes back to minus 90 at equilibrium. So we call that the equilibrium potential. It's this when the electrical attraction force is balanced with the diffusion force. All right, that's the equilibrium potential. And it's valid, we can calculate what it is, but only for one ion at a time. And in real life, it's about minus 90 millivolts. But how many ions do you have in your body? You got many, right? And then this equation right here doesn't work, but it's helpful to understand something about this equilibrium potential by looking at this equation. This is the Nernst equation. It tells us what the equilibrium potential will be when the electrical attraction is exactly balanced by the diffusion force. The diffusion force is going to be what? Exactly equal, but opposite to the electrical attraction force. And that's going to be determined by the concentration of some ions across the membrane. All right, so Nernst gives a membrane potential or voltage needed to counteract the concentration forces acting on an ion. And it depends on the ratio of ions inside and outside the cell. And this is what you can use your calculator for on the exam. You have some nice quantitative questions at the end of your chapter. So we have the equilibrium potential for an ion. How many ions can we put in here? One, two, three, okay, one species, like for instance potassium only or sodium only. If you want to calculate it with all these ions together, that's a different kind of equation, and that's not covered in your book anymore, which is too bad, which is a really nice equation. It's called Goldman's equation, but we're just going to look at the Nernst equation right here. So you have 61, that's a constant, that's always going to be the same. Right, and I'll give you this equation on the test. You don't have to memorize it, but you have to know how to use it. And then we have Z, 61 divided by Z, where Z is the valence of the ion. So, for instance, potassium, what's the valence of potassium? What kind of ion is it? It's positive. It's a cation. But what kind of cation? Could be monovalent, could be bivalent, could be trivalent. It's a monovalent cation. So Z, then, you would put a plus 1 right here. So that's how simple this is. What is 61 divided by plus 1? It's 61, right? Probably don't need a calculator for that. So if we're going to be using chloride, then what would be the valence for chloride ion? Then I would put a minus 1 right here. And if we're going to calculate it for calcium, what would we put in for Z? Plus 2, now it makes a big difference. Okay, so look at the valence of your ion, plug it in right here. And then this bracket right here represents the concentration of this particular ion. It's got to be the same as what we're using here, right? So, and it has to be the same in the numerator and denominator, except that in the numerator we put the concentration on the outside of the cell, and in the denominator we put the concentration that's inside the cell. So we would divide these two numbers together, then take the log of it. You know where your log button is on your calculator now, probably, or you're getting close to learning where it is. It gives you this number, and then you multiply that number by 61 divided by whatever the valence is. Okay, and mostly it's going to be 1 or minus 1, right? And it will change what the sign of the equilibrium potential is. Okay, so here we have a nice illustration of a cell. We see a plasma membrane. And you should practice calculating what the equilibrium potential is for sodium, right, and the equilibrium potential for potassium and chloride and calcium using this Nernst equation right here. So this is what, outside of the cell, that's what goes in the numerator. This is the concentration in millimolar, and as long as millimolar is the dimension for both the numerator and denominator, you don't need to make any corrections to this equation. And then it will tell you what the voltage is. All right, so please calculate equilibrium potential for potassium and sodium, and maybe even for chloride and calcium. The other thing that this slide shows is that the concentration of these different ions, right, is not equal across the membrane when this cell is at rest. All right, so you can see that for chlorine, it's 9 millimolar inside the cell and 125 outside the cell. I'm not going to ask you to memorize these numbers right here, but you should at least know what I want you to memorize. What is the gradient in these ions? For each of these ions, I want you to know where it is at high concentration. So for sodium, where is it at high concentration? Outside the cell. For potassium, where is it at high concentration? Inside. And for chloride? Outside. And for calcium? Way on the outside, right? That's a big concentration gradient, okay? So these are going to be really important considerations throughout the rest of the class. All right, so which ions are at a high concentration inside the cell? Okay, and it's only potassium. Which are at a high concentration outside the cell? Sodium, chloride, and calcium. Okay, because what does a cell do with this big concentration gradient right here? Okay, it can run different kinds of apparatus. It's an energy source. Okay, and it can also be used for switches, for turning things on, just like a light switch, or turning things off as well. Okay, so it's pretty important. I might have a little minor mistake in one of these. I might have to check over the weekend, but here you could check your work as well. All right, this is how you would calculate that. All right, so on the exam, on the 21st, remember, you cannot share calculators in here. It's got to be a non-graphing scientific calculator. And it's really good for you to practice ahead of time so that you don't try to figure out how your calculator works during the test. You probably have time, right? But just do it ahead of time so you can, your blood pressure doesn't go up, right? Just know how to do it ahead of time. See me or your lab instructors. All right, so when a cell's at rest, it produces that voltage. We call that the resting membrane potential when a cell's at rest. And I'm just going to say resting membrane potential as RMP from now on because I don't want to lose my voice by talking so much. All right, so RMP means resting membrane potential, but you should have an inherent feeling of what that is. What is resting membrane potential? It's the voltage that develops across the membrane when the cell is doing what? When it's being really active? No, when it's resting, when it's just doing nothing, okay, when it's at rest. RMP of most cells is between minus 65 and minus 85. All right, so what does that mean? Where's the minus? Let's go back. Where's the minus? On the inside of the cell. So it's the inside of the cell compared to the outside. Oh, I might be wrong about that. That's it for potassium, but yeah, okay, even for a regular cell. It's negative on the inside, positive on, I might have to say something about that in just a second. Okay, where was I at? Oh, right here. Minus 65, minus 85. on the inside compared to the outside. All right, and RMP depends on a number of different things. We looked at one thing, all right, using that Nernst equation. Depends on the concentrations of ions inside and outside the cell, and you can calculate what it is for one ion using that Nernst equation, but remember there's a whole bunch of ions that will contribute to that. It also is going to depend, resting RMP is going to depend on the permeability. All right, how easy is it for an ion to move across the plasma membrane? Sometimes there are channels inside the membrane that allows an ion to move across the membrane without the use of ATP or a pump. And when that happens, that's going to change RMP. And the ion that affects RMP the most is potassium because it has the most channels, and that means it has the easiest time moving across the membrane by itself. All right, now remember, potassium can't move through the membrane because of that hydrophobic region on the inside, but if there's a channel, it can go from high concentration to low concentration. So where would it normally move? How would potassium normally move if all of a sudden you put a channel in the membrane? Will it move from inside to outside by itself or outside to inside? It's going to go from high concentration to low. High concentration is inside the cell, so potassium is going to want to leak out. Okay. And when potassium leaves the cell, let's think of this. Do I have a diagram? Pretty good. When potassium leaves the cell, right, when it leaves, does the cell inside become more negative or positive when that happens? Then it becomes more negative because potassium is a cation. When potassium leaves, then the inside of the cell becomes more negative when that happens. All right, so some sodium moves in, but not a whole lot. More potassium leaves, and that makes the inside of the cell actually a little bit more negative than what you would expect because potassium can move down its concentration gradient. All right, so normally, if we could take into consideration all of the ions and all of the other features that are happening inside the cell, right, in this class, the usual kind of membrane potential or resting membrane potential is going to be minus 70 millivolts. So if it's minus 70 millivolts, what could you tell me about this nice healthy cell right here? It's resting, right? That membrane potential can change, okay? But when the cell goes back to a resting condition, what's going to happen to RMP? It's going to go back to minus 70, okay? Now say if this cell, think of a battery, if the cell is not doing anything, it's at rest, and you put a voltmeter across it and you read zero, what could you tell me about that cell? Just like your battery, it's what? It's dead, right? And unlike some batteries are rechargeable. You can get them to come back to life by recharging it. But a cell, unfortunately, once it's dead, as far as we know with our current level of understanding, it's what? It's dead forever, right? So that's the importance of this membrane potential. And one of the important things is that sodium-potassium pump, right, which requires ATP. So when cells run out of ATP, it can't maintain this resting membrane potential, and that cell dies when that happens. Maybe see me after class. Okay, so what are some of the other things that affect resting membrane potential? That sodium-potassium pump, because something I forgot to mention on the previous slide, all right, we see that sodium goes from inside to outside, and potassium goes from outside to inside the cell, but it's not an equal number of sodiums and potassiums. It's two potassiums for every three sodiums. So it's not an even exchange of electrical charge. So every time this pump works, right, it pumps more positive charge outside the cell, right? Three compared to two. So what happens to the inside of the cell when the sodium-potassium pump works? Does it become more positive or more negative? More negative because it's pumping more cations out than pumping cations in. All right, so we say that the sodium-potassium pump is electrogenic. It adds about minus 3 millivolts to resting membrane potential. All right, so here are all of the things, and you can't get a really good intuitive sense of what's happening right here. For instance, if we look at the equilibrium potential calculated for potassium, and if we calculate the equilibrium potential for sodium, oh, I was going to ask you what that is, but you know, right? For potassium, it's minus 90 millivolts, and for sodium, it's plus 66, and if we add these two together, what do we get? What do we get? 24? Okay, we get 24 millivolts, minus 24 millivolts, but in real life, what is it? It's minus 70, okay? So you can't just use the Nernst equation to calculate RMP because there's other things. One of the other things is what? The sodium-potassium pump, which is always adjusting RMP. And then the number of fixed anions inside the cell. And then, even more importantly, the permeability of the membrane to both sodium and potassium is going to affect the resting membrane potential. So there are a number of things that affect resting membrane potential. And in terms of your thinking, probably as we go through the class, it's going to be a change in permeability that's going to affect resting membrane potential the most. And that will be a little intuitive, not how all these things add up together, all right, to give you exactly minus 70. All right, we're not done with this chapter. We still got to talk about cell signaling. So I'm going to talk for a couple more minutes because we have two more lectures next week. And those are going to be on the exam, whether I get to talk about them or not. So I'd rather talk about them. Okay, so let's keep going. Cell signaling is just a way that cells can communicate with each other. And this can be over long distances in the body or short distances in the body. All right, and so the structural and functional unit of communication between cells is the synapse. I talked about that in anatomy. And I actually kind of like to use that as a theme throughout all my classes, like structural and functional unit. What's this, maybe somebody can remember, what's the structural and functional unit of life? What's a building block of life? It's a cell, okay? And what's the structural and functional unit of contraction? Ah, sarcomere, good. Yeah, you're kind of tracking with me a little bit. All right, so how do cells communicate with each other? What's the structural and functional unit of communication between cells? It's a synapse, all right? And it just so happens that there are two kinds of synapses, two kinds. You could characterize synapses of one of two kinds. One can be an electrical synapse, and the other can be a chemical synapse. And so the way that signals are transferred from one cell to another could be an electrical signal, or it could be a molecule, a chemical that goes from one cell to another that changes the physiology of the cell that's receiving that signal. All right, so here's the first kind. What do you see on this slide right here? I see phospholipid bilayer right away. That kind of jumps out at me. So here's the plasma membrane of one cell. And then here's the plasma membrane of a neighboring cell. For this particular arrangement of cells, right, they're not entirely separated from each other because these connexin proteins right here in the plasma membrane of one cell connect up to connexin proteins in the neighboring cell, and it forms a tunnel between these two cells. And that tunnel is big enough for sodium to move through it. So sodium can move from one cell to the other. All right, so let's put this cell at rest, and we have high sodium on the outside of the cell, but something changes the cell, opens up these channels so that sodium can enter the cell. Does sodium want to enter the cell? Yeah, because it's high on the outside, low on the inside, so sodium enters this cell. And don't forget, it's a cation, so it's going to change resting membrane potential. It's going to disrupt the resting membrane potential, and sodium enters. What happens to the inside of the cell? Does it get more positive or more negative? Or does it stay the same? It becomes less negative or more positive. You can think of it in either way, right? So the inside of the cell becomes more positive. That's an excitatory signal for this cell when it becomes less negative. We call that depolarization. We'll mention that a lot. But now you have high sodium in this cell and low sodium in this cell. What does sodium want to do? It's going to want to diffuse into this neighboring cell, and that's going to be another excitatory signal in the cell down below it. It's going to depolarize as a result of that. All right, so the second cell is communicating with the second one via that diffusion of sodium inside the cell. This is a really good example of an electrical synapse. This right here is what we call a gap junction, and maybe you could remember what kind of tissue has gap junctions. Maybe from anatomy, maybe. Okay, you really gotta stretch your memory. Cardiac muscle tissue has gap junctions. So that if we excite one cell in the heart, what happens to all the cells in the heart? They become excited as well, right? So the whole heart contracts as a unit, as it should, so that it can pump blood. Would you like to have gap junctions between all the skeletal muscle fibers in your body? No, that'd be terrible, right? Because I would reach for my Coke with my right arm, and what would happen to my body? all my whole body would contract, all right? Not very good. That's not an ecological advantage. I mean, evolutionary advantage. But for the heart, you have to do that. This is what we call a gap junction, okay? All right, so then we're done. We're going to finish talking about cell signaling and then move on to the next chapter next time. Sign-in sheet is going around, so make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. And I'm looking for students that weren't here on Monday. The other thing I got to mention, those of you that have lab on Tuesday afternoon, you guys are kind of in trouble because I think you're leaving that lab as a total disaster mess. Okay? So you guys got to work with your lab instructor because I don't want you to be in trouble or get your lab instructor in trouble. Which means you guys have lab this afternoon. Make sure you don't leave a mess in lab after lab. Thank you. Okay, have a great weekend, you guys.